Leaders are all around us, at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate, they risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Dr. John Haldane, holder of the J. Newton Razor Senior Distinguished Chair in Philosophy at Baylor University. Hosting the conversation is KWBU President Joe Riley. This conversation was recorded October 15th in the KWBU studio.
Welcome to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Joe Riley, talking today with Dr. John Haldane, J. Newton Razor Senior Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Baylor University, and also Professor of Moral Philosophy and Director of the Center for Ethics, Philosophy, and Public Affairs at the University of St. Andrews, Scotland, consultor to the Pontifical Council for Culture, and a frequent contributor to the BBC, among others. Welcome, Dr. Haldane.
Thank you very much. Very good to be here.
I want to just start, since we're here, this is Waco's public radio station. You are no stranger to broadcasting. And I just want to start, before we get into philosophy, with a little bit of your experience with them. I mean, particularly the BBC, you contribute fairly regularly to the BBC.
Yes, I have done, and over maybe 15 or 20 years now, I think. Yes, I mean, I think listeners, for the most part, if they hear the name BBC, will think of things like BBC World or BBC World Service. They'll think of it as a large and influential international broadcaster, which, of course, it is. But the BBC exists at different levels. So if we move down, we've got BBC World, BBC World Service. That's international. Then we have domestic BBC, BBC UK, essentially. But then embedded within that, you have local radio, regional radio, and since the United Kingdom is a union of kingdoms, within that we also have, for example, BBC Scotland. So my broadcasting over the years has really been at each of those levels. So just to illustrate, for example, for BBC Scotland, I used to do something called Thought for the Day, which was done at about 7:30 in the morning, live, and was a sort of 2 or 3 minute reflection. It's interesting, when I first started doing that, I used to be able to script those because they would like to have the script the night before just to check that it was always in order and so on. And when I first started doing this, it might take me an hour to write my 2 or 3 minutes. By the time I ended doing those, it would take me a day to write my 2 or 3 minutes. Well, and there are things, you run out of things to say, and you have to work harder and harder to try to, you know, to construct that. But that shows, you know, the seriousness of that kind of contribution. But then moving up from that, I would do UK-wide things, and then through BBC World Service, BBC World, and so on, international matters as well. So it's a very good discipline, I think, particularly for an academic who's inclined to write at great length, as academics do, to have to focus and concentrate your thoughts either in 2 or 3 minutes in a prepared little talk, or, as we are doing today, just in live broadcasting, to try to sort of, you know, get the point and limit the narrative. But it's been a good test, and it's something I've enjoyed doing.
How did you get started in that?
It's a good question, to which I think the answer is this, that I began in newspapers, and I used to write, and occasionally still do write, actually, for British newspapers, both again at the level of, say, within Scotland, the two main Scottish newspapers, but then also UK-wide. I used to write a monthly column in the London Times. There was a column called Credo, and there were four writers for that. There was the chief rabbi of the United Kingdom. There was an Episcopalian, an Anglican a priest. There was a member, I think a Methodist, and then I'm a Roman Catholic. Though I wasn't writing per se as a Roman Catholic, but nonetheless I was a Roman Catholic. And we used to write, take it in turn each week. And I did that for maybe 3 or 4 years. And I think that those pieces probably, you know, brought me to the attention of broadcasters. And I think that that probably, you know, led into the Thought for the Day, the broadcast Thought for the Day. It's a very similar sort of thing, a reflection. But also, I'm quite well known as a a sort of public intellectual, and so I would be contributing to debates around ethical questions, philosophical questions, and so on. And it's natural for that to then sort of migrate across from the public meeting, perhaps, or a forum or something of that sort, into broadcasting. So I think that was probably how it originated.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are a philosophy professor, but before you got there, you actually studied art. You taught art.
That's right, yeah.
Is there a connection between art and philosophy?
It's a good question. Let me explain why I studied art. The kind of education that I had as a boy, I mean, you know, going through the different stages of schooling, was fairly academic and fairly traditional, what I think might be called a classical education. And my teachers were not particularly keen on the idea that I should, when I left school, should go off and go to art school and do fine art. And the environment was one in which philosophical ideas were in the air, really. And I can see now that I was interested in philosophy then, but their determination that I should not do art was enough to resolve my determination that I would do art. And my father had been dissuaded by his father from going into music, which is what had interested him. So he wasn't going to stand in my way. He felt it was, if I wanted to do art, that was a good and important thing. And my mother had been a choreographer, and a lot of that side of my family are in film and theater and broadcasting and one thing and another. So there was that sort of art background. So I did art, and I did it for 5 years. I studied it for 5 years. And I then taught art, as you say. I actually taught, I was an art master in a private, what I think you'd probably call a prep school, something like that. But I also taught part-time in an architecture school in London. So it was a fairly serious career, really. But I think that, you know, after about 7 or 8 years in total there, the old philosophy bug that I'd picked up, you know, in childhood, I think really, which had never really left me, but I think I felt then that I actually wanted to give serious time and attention to that. I didn't at that point have any idea that I would become a professional philosopher. I just felt I really need to spend a few years seriously studying philosophy and so on. And did that fairly quickly as it happened. I mean, my progress through that was fairly speedy. So it did mean that I then had to consider what I was going to do. And so I resigned from my position teaching art, much to the surprise and dismay of the headmistress of the school which I was teaching. Well, I don't know, dismay, but anyway, surprise. And sort of threw myself into the world of full-time research, doing a PhD and so on. Now, in answer to your question of connections, yes, I think there are connections. I think partly this, that both the artist and the philosopher, in a sense, are trying to make sense of things. They're trying to sort of either impose a framework on things or discern some structure in them. So if you think, for example, of something like a still life, you know, just making a painting or of a set of objects on a table, what you're trying to do is discern or establish some relationship between those elements, to see them not as single elements, but in some sense within a kind of composition, as it were, put them into relationship. And I think as a philosopher, you're trying to not just see things as they are individually, but in some sense see how they hang together. So I think that's one way in which they were related. And a second way in which they're related, I think, is that this is more to do with the practice and the subject. I used to make hundreds of drawings. I mean, just draw, 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 draw. And the thing about that is you don't try to perfect it in the single drawing. You learn from each drawing. And as a philosopher, I've tended to work like that. I'm less concerned to try to, you know, produce the perfect essay, because there is no such thing. But I would rather, you know, get something right, and even if I get many things wrong, and then have another shot at it, another shot. So in a way, my philosophical practice, I've been relatively prolific, but I would say that's not necessarily that I've got a lot to say. I'm still trying to work out how to say the thing that needs to be said, just like the many drawings didn't mean that I was a great draftsman. It meant I was trying to learn through my drawing. So those two aspects, I think, both the trying to get a view of things and being willing to, you know, get it wrong and try again and mm-hmm. so on, both of those carried over into the way in which I do philosophy.
Mm-hmm. So you went to philosophy. You're a professor of philosophy. You I'm thinking of the way I believe most of the public probably thinks about philosophy, which is that it's a cerebral exercise. It's a lot of thinking, and I'm guessing that a lot of people wonder, oh, that's good, but what is the practical good of philosophy?
Well, philosophy historically, going all the way back to the period of the Greeks, so going back 2,500 and a little more years ago, has always had these two aspects or dimensions. The speculative side, I mean the metaphysical side, if you like, trying to work out what the nature of reality is, the cosmos and so on. That's really aiming at trying to get a description of reality. But the other side of philosophy, all the way back, is practical philosophy. So if you like, speculative philosophy asks the question, what is the nature of reality? Practical philosophy asks the question, what ought we to do? How should we live? And in particular, how should we live in the different departments or aspects of life, if you like? So social philosophy, political philosophy, moral philosophy, the philosophy of art, philosophy of language, in a sense. All of these are explorations of action in various ways and how we are going to live or how we should best live. So I think even from the outset, philosophy has had an aspect to it that forces it, as it were, out of the academy, if we put it that way, out of the lecture hall, into the forum of real life. Mm-hmm. And I would say, although I'm interested in both sides of philosophy, the way in which things have developed for me is that my primary interest is the question, how do these ideas bear upon the conduct of life?
For those of you who are just joining us, this is KWBU Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Joe Riley, talking today with Dr. John Haldane, the J. Newton Raisor Senior Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Baylor University. And we were talking about philosophy just a little bit earlier. Before we actually started recording, you talked about an idea of civic friendship. Where does that fit in?
Okay, good. So in thinking about these questions of conduct, obviously there are issues. The question, how should I live, put like that, is a question for each individual. How should I live? What values, principles, ideals should I guide my life by? But there's a different question we can ask, which is how should we live, this pluralized question. And that's a question about social groups, not necessarily about the state, because the society long before there's a state, and indeed the beginnings of society is the family. So these we questions, how should we live, how should we organize our lives and so on, arise before we get to the political level, but they obviously do arise at the political level as well. One concern that I have is that it seems to me that in recent times, excuse me a second. One concern that I have is that it seems to me that in recent times, this whole sphere of social and political philosophy has become deeply antagonistic. I think that in debating issues, whether these controversial issues, abortion, euthanasia, assisted suicide, whatever it may be, funding of the arts, there's been a tendency for parties on either side of these arguments to think that it's a complete win or lose. Right? The argument is presented, you go all out to win that, and if you haven't won it, you've lost it. And so there's a sort of killer aspect to this. Well, I think this is unserious. Issues wouldn't be controversial. We wouldn't be debating them if there weren't more than one reasonable view on the matter. Now, saying that is not to say there's no truth of the matter, it's not to be a relativist or anything of that sort, but it is to say that on these difficult and controversial issues, what makes them difficult is that we can see reasons to favor different answers. Somebody who is a pro-choice seems to me ought to be able to recognize that there are good pro-life arguments, and equally somebody who's pro-life ought to be able to recognize that an advocate of pro-choice is not either necessarily stupid or wicked. But, excuse me. So I think these parties ought to be able to recognize that either side can have a reasonable view on these matters, which is not to say there isn't a truth. But the way things have gone, there's this tendency to demonize the other, to think of the other as stupid, or to think of the other as bad in some way or another. This is hopeless. It's not only dishonest to the issues, it also breaks us apart as communities. So what I'm very interested in is promoting two ideas, really. One, the notion of reasonable disagreement, recognizing that in these areas, one's opponent can have reasonable views, which is not to yield to those views necessarily, but to recognize that. And to recognize that one's opponent as oneself, and to ask that your opponent recognize this in you, that we're both in pursuit of the good and the true. And that recognition then leads to what I call civic, or ought to lead to what I call civic friendship. This idea that we may disagree, but we are co-citizens, and we want the common good. We want to resolve matters in a way that has respect for one another and so on. I think it was very deep in the foundations of the United States, and one reason why I've chosen to come here is, and over the years I've spent a lot of time in the United States, I greatly admire the United States. And one reason for that admiration is that from the period of the framing of the Constitution and through those debates in Philadelphia and elsewhere, and in the 19th century and again in the 20th century, there has, I think, been a tradition of civic friendship in the United States. I fear the U.S. may be losing that now, but I don't think that I think that the U.S. can bring itself back to that. But this is really matters not just for the U.S., not just for the English-speaking world, but for the future of the civilized world, that we really work out how we can live together under conditions of disagreement.
Yeah, and along that, just to give a little more context, you're the chairman of the Royal Institute of Philosophy, so that I'm assuming that puts you in a position to translate some of these ideas for the...
To try to do so, and that's partly, of course, what my broadcasting has been about, my writing has been about, not just only in philosophical areas, but in other cultural questions as well. Yes, I mean, the Royal Institute of Philosophy was established in the early part of the 20th century by figures, some of whom will be, names at least, will be known to your listeners. Bertrand Russell, for example, was a very major figure. Somebody called Balfour, Lord Balfour, who will not be so well known, but was a British Prime Minister, was also a central figure in that. And its aim is to try to bring philosophy to a wider public. It puts on public lectures, conferences, one thing and another. But yes, I mean, I think one reason why I was asked to be the chair and one reason why I was very pleased to take up that position was that it was continuous, in a sense, with what I'd been doing, directing the Center for Ethics, Philosophy and Public Affairs, through broadcasting, through correspondence, to try to get academics to look outside their studies at the real world and to get people who are engaged in issues in the real world to think about the ethical and philosophical aspects of those issues.
Mm-hmm. You are a member of the... Pontifical Council for Culture, the Pontifical Academy of St. Thomas Aquinas, and there's, I think there's probably others, but this gets into a realm where it's not simply secular philosophy, but sure. There's Christian philosophy. There's you are in a place to bridge, I think, the secular and the religious here. Well, I'll let you take okay. that in
well,
a direction.
I'm a serious Christian. I would describe myself as an Orthodox Christian. I don't like, and we might come to this, I don't like the language of conservative, progressive, liberal, traditionalist. I rather speak in terms of being an Orthodox Christian, by which, of course, I don't mean necessarily not referring here to the Eastern Church, to the Orthodox Church, but what I mean is one who holds to the teachings of the Christian faith with regard to both doctrine on the one hand and morals on the other. That's what I mean by an Orthodox Christian. I've always been interested in religion. I'm a committed religious believer. I'm a Roman Catholic, as it happens. But I said earlier that I used to write a column, Credo, I believe, for the London Times. And partly, I think, through that and through other activities, in 2005, Pope Benedict appointed me as a consultor to the Pontifical Council for Culture, as you mentioned. The situation in the Vatican is that the Vatican is a curious and sometimes problematic place, but nonetheless, it it is made up of a series of kind of departments, as it were. And these include these various councils that are, that have responsibility for different spheres. And the Council for Culture was set up by John Paul II, actually, to try to engage a whole range of cultural questions, not just culture in the sense of the arts, but culture in the sense of the kind of prevailing ideas and values that are found. And we've done all sorts of different things. I mean, some of those have been at the fine art end. Painting, sculpture, and one thing and another, music. But some have been engagements. So, for instance, I was involved some years ago in a very interesting set of talks between the Roman Catholic Church and the Russian Orthodox Church. Our talks began in Vienna, and then a second round was held in Moscow. And the Russians gave to those talks the title Saving the Soul of Europe. Which is a very Russian way of thinking, or sort of romanticizing this. But nonetheless, the idea was that what we were talking about was the prevailing culture of Europe. And the Russians and those whom they represent were particularly concerned about what some trends that they see in Western society, which they think are secularizing, and not merely that, but anti-religious, and moving away from the traditional morals of Christendom. And so we were talking about those matters. So that's an area in which partly I'm acting as a philosopher, but partly just as a sort of general, as use the American phrase, public intellectual.
Mm-hmm. For those just joining us, this is the KWBU Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Joe Riley talking today with Dr. John Haldane. The Pope, well, Pope Francis now, in particular, is, I would say, and has been reported to be, a very popular pope. And this is not just among Catholics. Mm-hmm. I think he has caught the imagination of people sort of across the board. And I would say, especially here in the United States, this is what I know. And he recently visited the United States. Is it appropriate to think of a pope as a popular figure? Is that?
Well, there may be certain dangers in that, of course, which is if you stop being popular, you know, what harm does that do to the cause of Christianity, let's say? Let me just say, I think that this interest in the Pope, currently Pope Francis, of course, but I think it began really with John Paul II. I think up to that point, most people in the world, of course, they knew of the existence of the Pope. In the Vatican, but they wouldn't necessarily know who the presiding pope was or very much about them and so on. But really, maybe actually even with John the 23rd a little bit earlier, but I would say really with John Paul II, he was a very large figure in many respects. He'd been a dramatist, a poet. He was a philosopher. He was a very gifted man, a very charming man. And I think that he really sort of took the world stage by storm, I should put it that way. I remember actually being in Warsaw, I think, or Krakow in Poland, 20 years ago, and the president of the university then said that, you know, the world had been saved by three or four people, and he mentioned Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, and Karol Wojtyła, the Pope. And he was really talking about the influence of the Pope in breaking down communism and so on. So I think that was really where this began, this interest in popes really begins with John Paul II. Benedict, very different personality, but nonetheless, great interest in him. Now, with Francis, I think the part of what people like or respond to is the informality, the idea that he responds directly and immediately. He seems to lack the what people might have thought of as the kind of regal associations of a ruling figure or something of that sort. So I think that's part of it. And yes, you're right. I mean, there is great interest in him. I think I'll just add one thing that I think is a bit more serious than that, which is that other Christian denominations, as they see these challenges from secularism and elsewhere to Christianity, have become conscious of a certain vulnerability on their part, which is the lack of leadership. Of course, the different denominations will literally have leaders, but often these are elected offices. They're people who people don't really recognize who they are. They come and they go and so on. And the office of the papacy, the Pope, has come to be seen by many Christians, including Baptists, evangelicals, and others, as somehow a figure who represents Christianity more broadly. And so in these, as we see these battles, as it were, developing between the Christian worldview, the atheist worldview, and so on, I think the value of the Pope for Christians in general has been that here is somebody who, as it were, is represents them or their worldview. So there's a lot of interest and support for the Pope, leaving aside details, but in general, comes from Christians who think that, yes, this is good. We've got somebody there who, as it were, is a world figure and can give voice to Christian values and Christian commitment.
Mm-hmm. Much of what we know about the Pope comes from the way he is reported on, from journalists. Mm-hmm. How would you characterize that reporting?
Well, I think it's not good for the most part. And a big issue here is the tendency to politicize coverage of the Pope. And I think this has really originated in the United States. I think it's a kind of lazy journalism that thinks of the Pope as if it was the President of the United States or a papal contender, as if they were, you know, the nominee from one of the big parties. And so people just slide over the whole language of conservative, liberal, progressive, traditionalists, and so on, and then ask themselves the question, you know, where's he? And also they think that somehow popes like presidents can sort of bring in a whole new range of policies, sweep things away. It isn't like that, right? The Pope sees himself as the inheritor of the apostolic commission given to Peter, and the Catholic bishops see themselves in the same way. So their primary responsibility is not to come up with new ideas. It's to hand on what they believe was given to them, the so-called deposit of faith, not to let any drop of that pass from their hands. So you might say that it's in the nature of the papacy that it is intrinsically, I'll put it this way, preservative office. It's about preserving the deposit of faith, not about coming up with policies and initiatives. And I think that journalists just find that very difficult, in part because they're religiously ignorant, I'm afraid.
This is something I think we could talk, you know, another half hour on easily, and not get to the end of it. Just to wrap up, what you're doing now, you've come to Waco, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about Texas. And
well, I'm enjoying it. It's, of course, for somebody coming from a country as small as Scotland, or indeed any European country, Texas, of course, is huge, and that's the first thing that strikes one. I'm also aware, but it's much more varied than I think people outside the United States, or perhaps even within the United States and outside of Texas, are aware. I mean, the landscape varies enormously from west to east and so on. My wife and I, we were enjoying it. We've only been here about 6 weeks, but we've been down to Houston, we've been over to San Antonio, we've been to Austin and so on. So we look forward to exploring it. The people are very friendly. The environment is very supportive. I admire what Baylor's doing. I'm very glad to be part of the Baylor project, as it were. I think that's very important for the future of higher education here in the United States, and important for the Christian intellectual tradition.
Wonderful. Dr. John Haldane, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. John Haldane, holder of the J. Newton Raiser Senior Distinguished Chair in Philosophy at Baylor University. This conversation was recorded October 15th in the KWBU studio. This has been the Central Texas Leadership Series. For this episode and past episodes, visit our website at kwbu.org.